Go. Okay, so Parshas Chukas, and if you have a chumash, it's in a perek Yud Tes in a Sefer Bamidbar. We're discussing the idea of a chok, Chukas HaTorah. And what the parasha will then describe is, of course, the Para Aduma, which the red heifer that had to be used to purify people. And just, it's a very important idea to understand what exactly does this mean, a chok? We know that there's two types of mitzvos, right? There are the chukim and mishpatim. There's the things we understand and things we don't understand. So let's just for a second go through a little bit of what this means. Now, one reason we have a chok is simply because we have to have certain mitzvos that we don't know, and we follow HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's part of our emunah system. Part of our emunah system is that we don't understand everything. And the fact that we don't understand everything is actually what builds more of our faith, not takes away from our faith. Right? And that's this idea of a chok. Now, whether or not, even within a chok, a person can still search for meaning is an interesting machlokes. In fact, the Rambam says you can. And even though if something is a chok, it doesn't mean that you can't necessarily find a meaning to it. You might not find the meaning to it, but it doesn't mean that you won't find a meaning to it. And in fact, if you look here, there's a beautiful piece. Hold on, let's go back to the top here. Here we go. In this Medrash, the Medrash tells a story about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. The story goes that a pagan once asked Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the rituals you do, they seem like witchcraft. You bring a heifer, you burn it, you crush it up, right? Seems strange. If one of you is impure by the dead, the highest of impurity, two or three drops are sprinkled on him and you declare him pure. He said to him, has a restless spirit ever entered you? He said to him, no. Have you ever seen a man with a restless spirit? Yes. So what do? So the man says, oh, you're right. We brought roots and made them smoke beneath him and pour water and in fleas. He said to him, all right, listen, you do the same thing. So the guy leaves the office of Yochanan ben Zakkai, and the two students of Yochanan ben Zakkai say, Rebbe, what in the world just happened? Here we are. We think it's a chok. We don't understand it. It's a munah. And you just told this guy, whatever, we do it because, you know, it makes the guy pure. So his student said to him, what are you going to say to us? So he says, by your lives, he says, a dead person doesn't make things impure, and water doesn't make things pure. Rather, God said, I have engraved a rule and made a decree, chukas chukakti, gezera gazarti. And you have no permission to transgress what I decreed. That's a chok. And as Nechama Leibowitz here beautifully explains it, Nechama Leibowitz writes, the heathen required a rational explanation appealing to his common sense. The Torah's defilement is a kind of disease or evil spirit. So the red heifer is no more of a cure for the disease. But he could tell his disciples, right? He could tell his Talmidim, students of the Torah who accepted its yoke, the truth. Uncleanliness is not an integral part of nature. Hold on, let's do this. There we go. Rather, she says, it is a divine commandment that alone determines the defilement of a corpse and the purifactory properties of the ashes. Meaning, there is a certain aspect to our relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that there are certain things that we don't understand. And that's what it means to be a chok. Yes, a person should find meaning. A person should find significance. You can search for it, says the Rambam. But it doesn't mean that you'll necessarily find the reason. And this is a tenet of our emunah. You know, in fact, when we so often talk about things that we don't understand, one of the things that's important to remember, one of the things that when we, especially during counseling or after a chas v'shalom tragedy, is that when something terrible happens, you can't search for a reason, because there will never ever be a reason in which somebody says, that's why such a thing had to happen. That's a chok also. A chok isn't just a mitzvah, shatness, klayim, kashrus, paraduma that I don't understand, but I believe it, and that's important. It's part of the fabric of our emunah system. Part of the fabric of our emunah system is that God is, there's a distance between ourselves and God. We cannot know everything. And when we realize that we can't know everything, that they say that's what makes a gadol a gadol. What makes a great leader a great leader? because they realize that the distance between themselves and God is very far. Obviously, we want to be close. There are certain things we don't understand, and that's part of our religion. So that's the beginning of a chok. We're going to come back to what's going to happen with Moshe and hitting the rock. That will be the focus of tonight's shir. But there's also in Chukas a little bit of a shira as well, a little bit of a song towards the end of Parshas Chukas. And then, of course, you get to Parshas Balak. So we don't really have the time to fully get into Balak and then fully get into Chukas. We'd be here for a long time. So just obviously to sum it up quickly, Balak sees what's happening to the Jews, and Balak decides that he needs to get the Jews. He's got to get them somehow. So he hires Bilam. Bilam, even though originally refuses to go, he had enough motivation eventually to go, even though Kadosh Baruch himself told him not to go. And Bilam decides to go ahead. Bilam goes, and we know the story. There's the talking, the talking donkey. One of these times in Tanakh when the Pasuk says that he lifted up his eyes to see what was in front of him, when the Malach was standing in front of him and the donkey couldn't go past, lifting up eyes sometimes means you just see what was already there. When Avram lifts up his eyes and sees the ram at the Akedah, the ram was already there. Either way, Bilam tries to curse the Jews a number of times, and every time he tries to curse them, it doesn't work. He ends up blessing the Jewish people. I just want to point out, because I think, especially in the times in which we are living, a very important piece. One of the brachos that Bilam, of course, gives to the Jews is Matovu Alecha Yaakov. All right, Matovu Alecha Yaakov, how great are your tents, Yaakov, Mishkan Osecha, Yisrael. And Rashi's interpretation is that Shalra Pischeim Shina Mechavdin Zem Mulzeh. Their tents were not directly opposite each other. You couldn't see into each other's homes. This Rashi's point, before we even get to Matov Alecha, Rashi's point is that the Jews lived with modesty. The Jews themselves weren't looking over the yard. What's that guy having? What's this guy having? What kind of car is he driving? Oh, look what he's doing to his yard. Look what he's building to his house. It was a sense of tznius, in the sense, I lived in my house, you lived in your house, everybody did their own thing. And Bilam is so wowed by the fact that people could live in such an environment in which they didn't need to live opposite of their neighbor. I lived here, you lived there, we all got along. Everything was great. So that's one aspect of Matovu Alecha Yaakov. There's a fascinating machlokas. We know that Matovu Alecha Yaakov, even if you now were slowly, some of us are able to come back to Shul. Mirtz Hashem, soon, everybody, hello Ella, it's good to see you. Everybody will come back to Shul at some point, Mirtz Hashem. So we know that even if you're davening at home, maybe you said, Berachos HaShachar, the first thing you're supposed to say when you get to Shul is Matovu. That's what you're supposed to say when you get into Shul, Matovu Alecha Yaakov. So it's a strange thing. Why in the world, if I could tell you, all right, let's look through Tanakh, everybody pick a pasuk we should start davening with. Nobody. I can't imagine anybody's going to pick Matovu Alecha Yaakov. Why? Even though it's a beautiful pasuk, because it was said by a Rasha. The Rasha was Bilam. He tries to curse the Jews over and over, and at his last cursing, he ends up blessing them. But why in the world would this be the beginning of how we start davening? In effect, the Maharshal says, or Shlomo Luria in the 16th century, the Maharshal writes, Uva Boker, Kishani Balabes Akanesses, when I get in there, Maschel Aniba Pasuk Vaniberov. I started Pasuk 2. Umidale got Pasuk Arishon, he says, and I skipped the first Pasuk. It's fascinating. Why? Because Bilam said it. And not only was it said by a Rasha, it was said to curse the Jewish people. So leaving the Maharshal's opinion aside, we do say Matov Alecha Yaakov every time we come to Shul. Why do we do that? So listen to Rabbi Lam. Rabbi Lam Ushloshim was just this past week, who I mentioned a few weeks ago, but maybe in this class, that Rabbi Lam was a master darshan. He had the ability to find a drasha on everything and to give it over with so much Torah and so much emotion and so much musar at times. It's unbelievable to read Rabbi Lamb's drasha. So Rabbi Lamb says in 1954, he says, "And our people at large do not accept the verdict of the Maharshal. We've accepted Matovu. We've given it the place of honor. It's become the darling of cantors and liturgical composers." Right. So why is it? He writes an amazing, amazing line. He says the following here. He says, "If all of Israel is accepted and accorded with such honors, there must be something very special about it that somehow reflects an aspect of the basic personality of the Jew. The unique aspect of our collective character," he says, "is to wring a blessing out of a curse. We say Matovu not despite the fact that it was intended to harm us, but because of the fact." It is Jewish. This is a great line. It is Jewish to find the benediction in the malediction, the good in the evil, the opportunity in the catastrophe. It is Jewish to make the best of the worst, to squeeze holiness out of profanity. And in fact, he actually uses this to describe the beginning of Hasidus, which was really at a time of low morale in the Jewish people. That's really for a different discussion. But Rabbi Lamb's point, which is extremely important, that it's Jewish to find the benediction in the malediction. Meaning Bilam wanted to curse the Bate Kinesios and the Bate Midrashos. That's what he wants to say on this pasuk, right? And we take that same line of Bilam and we say it in those same shuls, right? It's like when they take the emblem of the menorah, the Arch of Titus, and make it in the emblem of the State of Israel. Take that, Titus. Look what you wanted to do. Look where we are. And that we find the good in the evil. We squeeze it out. That, look what's happened the last few months. We've squeezed out good out of tragedy and out of evil, in a sense. We found benediction in the malediction. And Rabbi Sachs, Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, was once asked, give him the defining moments in Jewish history. So he says, "I don't have defining moments," but he says, "I can tell you that any time that we've seen defeated or knocked down or beat up, we have not only regrouped, but somehow managed to produce the new positive." And he said, "Look at Jewish history. Destruction in the first Beis HaMikdash produces Torah Shabbat Be, Mishnah, Gemara, Misorah. That's a Mat Tovu attitude. Second Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. We lost our home, God's home, exile. We developed Tefillah, Mat Tovu attitude. After the Crusades decimated the European Rhineland in 1096, we responded with the Balei Tosfos, a whole generation of Rishonim, Matovu Alecha Yaakov. After the Spanish Inquisition, we were forced to flee. We produced Kabbalist, Tzvat, a whole new era of an area of Jewish learning. After the Holocaust, the State of Israel, explosion of Torah learning. And that's this benediction and the malediction. And I think when the book is written on this period of Jewish history, we can say that we found, as difficult as it was, we found the benediction and the malediction. We found opportunities for chesed, opportunities for learning, growth. You know, don't worry. You know, a few people actually this week have said to me that they hope as Shul reopens, online learning won't go away. It's not going away. Online learning, it might be a hybrid, but there's so many things that have happened that we found the good necessarily in the evil. Okay, but now we're already running out of time. We're going to go back in Parshas Chukas to talk about probably, you know, the story that really dominates Parshas Chukas, and that is the story of Moshe hitting the rock. Now, it happens to be that this story is very dear to my heart. The reason being, now, it's not my personality to sort of skip tests and, like, not do work. I didn't get good grades, but I was a good student. I was studious, but I did not get good grades. Now, if you want to think, oh, you're the rabbi, you're God. No, I really, really did not get good grades. But when I got to YU, my first year in YU, I took Professor Carmi in Intro to Bible. It's an amazing, amazing class. And as the end of the semester is coming, and it was really only one test and one paper, I was told by the older guys, don't worry about the paper. You can do it later. As long as you give it to him at some point, it'll be fine. So I don't know why I listened, but I guess I admit finals, my first semester. I'm like, okay, I'll do it at some point. A year later, I look at my transcript and I still had an incomplete for my Intro to Bible. So obviously you have to, you know, graduate. So I decided to research this topic, the story of Mei Meriva. And then I found the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh, who just quotes all the opinions, and I basically just quoted all those opinions and then did some more research, and I got my paper, and I still passed the class. So let's go back to the story about Moshe hitting the rock, and let's understand from a few Rishonim and actually a few contemporary opinions what exactly was the sin of Moshe and what do we learn from it. Okay, so let me first go to the Psukim. So the pasuk tells us that after they go, they travel a little bit further. Vayavo ben Esau kol eidah midbar tzim achodesh harishon vayeshev amik kadesh. Miriam dies. Vayamayim lo eidah, there is no water. Vayikalu amosho v'yal aron. They begin to gather amosho and aron. They need water. Vayarev ha'amim Moshe, they begin to fight with him. Vayomru leimar v'luga vanu b'gva achenu lefnei Hashem. If we only had died, God's hand, how come you brought us here to die in this desert? And why did you bring us to this land to die? It's not a place of Zera, Teina, Gevin, Riman, Mayim, Ayin, Lishtos. We can't even have water. So Moshe and Aaron go to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu says the following, Pasuk Ches. Take your step, gather the Jews onto Aaron Ochicha v'dibartem el haselah. So Moshe is told, go, take your mate, but speak to the rock. V'nosan mimov, it'll give water. V'hotzesel em mayim en haselah v'ishkiso asa'idu bi'ira. Right, so Moshe is told by God, speak to the rock, and water will come forth. Moshe goes, takes his staff, brings the Jews together, pasuk test. Vayikach Moshe samata milifnei Hashem kasher tzivo. He takes his staff just like he was told. Vayakila Moshe v'yaro neskola pnei asel. He gathers them together. Vayomru lahem. Now listen to the pasuk. Shimona amorim, says Moshe. Listen, you rebels. Hamen asel hazeh noti lachem mayim. Should we get water from this rock? And he takes his hand and he takes his mate and he hits the staff twice and water comes out and he feeds the people, get water. Sukkim continue. It's good to know the whole story a little bit. God looks at Moshe and says, Moshe, you didn't trust me, lahakti sheni, to sanctify my name, le'nei b'nei Yisrael, and therefore, Lo savio es ha-kahal hazeh el ha-aretz asher nasati lam. You cannot bring the Jews. This place will be known as Mei Meriva because there is where the Jews fought. So the question is, what exactly went wrong? What was the sin of Moshe here? Now, the easiest explanation is the simplest, is Rashi. The sin was that he hit the rock. He was told not to hit the rock, but he hit the rock. The if you look here, I'll share. I believe I quoted it for you. The Rambam says the following: his whole sin lay in erring on the side of anger and deviating from the mean of patience. When he says, "Hear ye rebels," this behavior in such a man constituted a profanation of the name, meaning he already assumes when he says this. He's taking under his assumption that God is, when they heard that, they said, oh my gosh, God is angry at us. Right? Take it, play it back. Here are the Jews. Moshe, we need water. Moshe's okay. He goes to God. God says, go hit the rock. Moshe comes back and Moshe says, all right, rebels, here's the water. So the Jews think, oh my gosh, God's angry at us. What do we do wrong? God didn't say he was angry. God didn't get upset at the Jewish people. God didn't say like he did in last week's parsha, let's wipe him out. God didn't say it was shalach, like the meraglim, we're done. God said, go get water. So now the Jews are under the assumption that perhaps Hashem is angry at them. That's the Rambam. The Ramban gives a little bit of a different approach. The Ramban says, the Torah speaks of Moshe not believing in God. Nowhere mentions that Moshe was angry, of waxed wrath. Aaron was never guilty of anger. His whole life was one of peace. How can Maimonides claim that God was not angry with them, and it was Moshe who gave the wrong impression? So he looks here, says the Ramban, Moshe made the fatal mistake of saying, shall we bring forth water? Instead of saying, shall God bring forth water? Now, there's a number of other explanations as to what exactly the sin of Moshe was. The Nitziv, for example, the Nitziv says the following. This was just really bad timing. It was just really, really bad timing. Right? This was supposed to be, what year are we right now in Jewish history? We just skipped ahead 38 years. 38 years are done, and now we're ready to go into Israel. We're basically there. This was a massive transition from miraculous to the natural. Once the Jews get into Israel, yes, God was going to fight with them, of course, but it will not look like it did in the Midbar. In fact, when we did the story of the Meraglim, we mentioned that was one of the issues the Meraglim had. They want to stay in Midbar life. They liked it. It was easier. It was simpler. It was more comfortable. It was more secure. It was holier. And now we're transitioning to the natural order. So Moshe should have taken the rock and should have said, at this moment, instead of hitting it, he should have spoken to it. Why? Because what's going to happen when the Jews get to Israel? They're going to have to, v'dibartem, they're going to have to speak, talk to God, ask God for things, daven to him. In the Midbar, it was handed to them. The man fell every day. The clothes grew. The fire wiped out everything. The cloud cleared the path. But now, all of a sudden, in Israel, it's going to be v'dibartem el ha'sela. The desert had all of those things. Israel will not. Israel will not have all of these great amenities when you go to a fancy resort. It's not going to have all of these things that they're going to take care of you. You have to be able to be on your own. And therefore, the message was, this was a transformational time. So they went to Moshe, and they needed something miraculous. So what should have happened was, Hashem says, take your matet, but don't hit it this time. Speak to it. Speak to the rock. And of course, we know that it doesn't play out in that way. But that's this idea of a dibartem. This is, we say in the keynotes on Tisha B'Av, if I could find the words to find you, God. This is tefillah. Using our words to connect with dibartem, el ha'sela. They tell amazing story of the Baal Shem Tov. The story of the Baal Shem Tov goes that a young boy comes to in town with his father. The father's got to run a bunch of errands. So he tells the boys, sit here in the synagogue. So there are people davening back and forth, deeply involved, engrossed. Kavana, he has no idea how to daven, doesn't know how to read Hebrew. So someone sticks a sitter in his hand. The young boy opens up the sitter and he starts saying the Aleph Beis. And he says, listen, I don't know how to read. I don't know any prayers. I don't know Hebrew. But please take what I'm doing to you as a prayer. Says the Baal Shem Tov, there's been no more beautiful tefillah. That's what it means, v'dibartem el ha'sela, and that's what they missed here. They missed that message to them as they were about to transition to the land of Israel. Okay. But I want to move on and discuss, actually, fast forward, to share with you a number of more contemporary opinions as to what exactly the sin of Moshe and Aaron was. And one of the issues we run into when we discuss this story about Moshe and Aaron, is it seems as the Shadal Reim, Shmuel David Lutzato, that Moshe does one thing wrong, but we've heaped on him many things that he did wrong. Moshe can only do one thing wrong. We have to figure out what exactly is that thing, and why is it so bad. So let me share with you Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, the Chitah Levracha, gives a beautiful explanation as to what exactly goes wrong. And he says the following. He says, in light of all of the above in his presentation, we must seek another way of understanding the sin. The verse does not say that they sinned, but rather they did not sanctify God's name. Right? Doesn't say, oh my gosh, you were wrong. I'm going to give you an X. You sinned. Pasuk says, you didn't sanctify me in the eyes of B'nai Yisrael. Says Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, and this is alluded to a number of Rishonim as well. Had they spoken to the rock, God's name would have been sanctified to a much greater degree. Everyone would have witnessed the obedience of the rock, and there would be a clear demonstration of the verse, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit. Meaning, this was like the Netziv says, this was a major moment. Moshe's going to take the rock, the staff, and he's not going to hit it. He's just going to talk to the rock. And even the rock is going to listen to God. What an amazing lesson for the Jewish people. And when Moshe and Aaron don't do that, it's not that they did something wrong, but that they missed an opportunity to do something. And that, says Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, that was their mistake. Moshe and Aaron missed a golden opportunity that perhaps would never be repeated. Although it was Moshe who struck rather than speaking, Aaron is also punished because he hesitated rather than speaking immediately to the rock. They're responsible for the missed opportunity. The failure is not only severely punished, but is referred to with great severity. Later on in Parsha, God says, Aaron will be gathered because he rebelled against my word. And Rav Aaron goes on to describe this idea of missed opportunity. We are judged as Jews. It's a little bit scary to think, but we are judged as Jews not only on what we do, but on the opportunities that we've taken, and maybe the opportunities that we haven't. And therefore, says Rav Aaron, that's what Moshe and Aaron judge on. He says there's two reasons for being judged this way. Number one, it's wasted potential. And if I could have done an amazing thing and I don't do it, I missed my mark. I missed the mission. Right? And such missed opportunity arises at best from laziness and at worst from apathy. And that's Rav Aaron's point. Rav Aaron's point is that we are judged not only are we judged for what we did. Moshe and Aaron said, I told you to speak to it and you hit it. You missed an opportunity. And it's so important to think about how we go about our lives. Every little thing that comes across our table, every opportunity we have, doesn't mean we should be running to do every single thing and disregarding our other responsibilities. But a chance for everything is an opportunity. And we have to make sure that we take all of those. Now, the truth is that there is an opinion of Rav Yosef Alba. Rav Yosef Alba was a great 15th century Spanish philosopher. So he says that Moshe Rabbeinu was a great prophet. He was a great Navi. And like all great prophets in history, Moshe should have understood that at this moment, a miracle was warranted. Right? It was warranted. He could have inspired the people. He should have attempted to bring the water out. His mistake, says Rav Yosef Albo, was that he actually went to ask God. It's an amazing thing. Because he went to ask God what to do, he diminished the miracle. Come on, how is that a sin? How could that be wrong? It's humility. So in the world of psychology, there is something called a self-fulfilling prophecy. That's when a person unknowingly basically causes a prediction to come true due to the simple fact that he believes it's going to come true. Right, for example, a high school coach who puts in a player who barely ever plays, performs terribly in the 1 minute he's in, the coach says, I knew he was going to be bad. Of course he's bad, because he put him in one time. So Rav Yosef Albo says that Moshe's mistake was that he didn't think enough of himself. He didn't think enough of himself to go and do the miracle. And in fact, his sin and his mistake was his lacking of this confidence in who he was as a person and he was as a leader. And the truth is that we're starting in next week is a week from tomorrow is Shavuot Betamuz. So there's already in 3 weeks mode in Tishah B'Av mode, which is just always a good reminder that even though it's the 3 weeks coming up, Debbie, it's almost Pesach. So just get prepared. Okay. But the truth is that there is a story that we talk about over this period of time that is very much speaks to this lesson. The story goes like this. We know about the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, that basically in an act of revenge against this guy has a party, and even though they invited by accident his enemy and not his friend, and when his enemy Bar Kamsa, it's not even his name, but when his enemy Bar Kamsa shows up, he basically tries to kick him out. After finally kicking him out, even though the guy tries to stick around, he wants to take revenge against the rabbis who stood by and watched. So as proof to his charge that the Jews are rebelling, he tells the emperor, The emperor says, take a sacrifice to the Beis HaMikdash, see if they offer it. So he wounds the animal in a way that it's unfit for Jews, not for non-Jews. And when they get there, the rabbis have an argument. And Rabbi Zechariah ben Avkulas rejects both ways. He says, well, if we kill the guy, then everybody's going to say, oh my gosh, they kill people who bring blemished animals. If we don't do anything, they're going to say, oh, look what they're offering. So they don't do anything. And the Gemara says, the humility of Rabbi Zechariah ben Avkulas destroyed the Beis HaMikdash and exiled us from the land. So Rabbi Yaakov Emden says that Rabbi Yochanan attributes one of the worst calamities in Jewish history to misused humility. Humility should be that I'm down on myself. It should be that I want to grow, I have more to accomplish. But we should feel confident in ourselves. And even Moshe Rabbeinu says, of Yosef Albo, doesn't have as much confidence perhaps as he should have. It's a fascinating opinion of Yosef Albo. And I'll leave you with one more approach. One more approach to the sin of Moshe and Aaron. And it comes from a number of opinions, contemporary opinions, including Rav Yaakov Meidan, Rav Yitzhak Et Shalom. And it's something to think about. This is nothing to do with the hitting, the speaking, the rebels, the anger. It is simply the fact that let's look at where we are right now. Now let's remember, in Bahaloscha, a few weeks ago, Moshe says, I cannot do this alone. I just can't. I can't carry them alone. Anochi asa levadi, I can't do it. So God says, okay, I'm going to give you Shivim Zakein. Okay? I'm going to give you Shivim Zakein. Fast forward 38 years. 38 years we fast forward. We would imagine, if we didn't know this parsha, and we were unlearned, we would imagine 38 years later, the curtains open, and it's a much better functioning society. There's layers of leadership. Who do I go to? Who do I call? Right, who's the best person, who's this contact, right? Not everybody has to go to the principal for everything. Do you go to the administrator? Do you go to the social worker? Do you go to the psychologist? You would imagine that we open the parsha, Parshas Chukas, 38 years later, the complaints are getting filed in a normal order of succession and of division of leadership. And yet, what happens? The Jews are complaining, and right away, who do they complain to? Moshe and Aaron. Back to the same place we were 38 years earlier. So therefore, God now can't, obviously is not going to say, all right, let's wipe them out again. Let's start fresh. At this point, that's why God has to say to Moshe, you can't go. Not because maybe a sin, maybe not a sin. Because if you go every time the Jews have an issue, they're going to run back to you. You're going to go into Israel, spread out the land, north to south, east to west. Everybody's going to have their own property. What's going to happen if the guy in Tzvat or the guy in Tveria, you know, or the guy on the Shomron has an issue? They're going to come running back to you. Look at this dependency. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe, you can't go. As difficult as it is and as hard as it is for the Jews to blossom and to function and to grow organically into the nation they're supposed to be, they need to be on their own. And we see what happens. It comes with issues and troubles and back and forth and with Yoshua and then the Shoftim. It's not easy. We're still trying to figure things out. But there's this very, very important balance here between leadership and between dependence. We need leaders. That is clear even from Korach. There has to be a hierarchy that does not take away from my role. Now, we see this in a number of factions within our lives today, right? For example, Gedolim. I'm the first person to tell you, go to Gedolim, see Gedolim, get brachos from Gedolim, bring your children to Gedolim. But that doesn't take away from my relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The fact that a Gedol is davening for me doesn't mean that I'm not davening for myself. Right? Visiting Kivrei Tzadikim. Amazing, important, inspirational. Doesn't mean that if I visit a kever, I'm better off now because now they're davening for me. We have to realize that even HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe, you can't go. the Jews have to rise to that level. And right now, 38 years later, they're still complaining on their own. And I think when you sort of put those two pieces together, this idea of leadership and Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's point about missed opportunities, it really paints a full picture about what the responsibility of a Jew is. That a Jew has tremendous responsibility. And he is judged, every single Jew is judged by what they do, what they accomplish, and Amir Tashem, all that we accomplish, and no missed opportunities. So because God values our role and our impact, and anything that we do that we miss, God says that's a problem because you missed it. Not only Moshe, every single Jew. And that's why we had to realize that it's not just Moshe. Moshe is great. He's the greatest Navi. He's the greatest prophet. He's an Eved of Hashem. He's humble. He's pal peh. But he doesn't take place of any other Jew. And when we put these together, the sin of Moshe is something that really should resonate with us. But not the sin of Moshe, the sin of Meimariva, in that we understand that it's our responsibility to go through life asking ourselves, how can I be like who I am? How can I make sure that every opportunity I take, every chance for chesed that I do, every chance for Torah learning I do, and that I understand that even though I go to leaders and rabbanim and gedolim, I also have to have a voice, and I also have to have a tefillah. Doesn't mean we should start paskening on our own. That's why you need a hierarchy. But it means that we understand the impact that each and every single Jew has in this world, and the responsibility and the accountability that we have living and functioning as an Eved Hashem.